Good morning. My name is Jessica Sievers. I'm the board secretary here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Welcome to our service on healing the political and the personal. Don't run out the door. We're going to keep it rated G. Here we have no required creed. We believe in the liberal ideal that each person finds his or her own path, whether it's working towards peace, particular social justice goals, or other religious destinations. And so I welcome you. Whatever path brought you here, wherever path you leave when you go, and I ask you to join us today with an open heart and an open mind. And I will greet you with the same. We invite our visitors and guests to sign the guest book that's out in the narthex on the welcome table. On that forum, you can request a complimentary subscription to our newsletter. If you're curious about what we're about or what is Unitarian Universalism in general, I encourage you to talk with people after the service. And then everyone is invited to join us for coffee and continued conversation down the hall in the Alsop room after the service. So in the spirit of community, I ask you to take a moment to greet those around you. So before we begin the service, there's a few announcements. I'll draw your attention to the inserts in the program. The first one is Trunk or Treat will be next Sunday. After the service, we'll start at 12:30 down in the parking lot. It's fun for everyone, so everybody can dress up, have a costume, decorate your car to hand treats out of or goodies. Somebody's going to be a pizza oven and pass out pizza and beer if you're old enough. So just to get a few ideas. It'll be a lot of fun. The other side is about the welcoming hospitality after the Sunday service, November 13th. You can read more about that in the program. And then I do have one additional announcement. On Saturday the 29th at 1 o'clock, Reverend John Stone will lead a memorial service for longtime member Jack Warren here at the Fellowship. Everyone is more than welcome to celebrate this man's extraordinary life. At noon on Wednesday, the 26th, this week, there's a brief burial service with military honors for Jack at the Sunrise Cemetery. Because Jack was instrumental in founding and sustaining the Wednesday's men's lunch here, the fellowship men will gather there for an informal time to remember our friend. And of course, if any of his female friends would like to join, they're more than welcome to. I invite Nick McGoy up to light our chalice. This poem is by Elizabeth Tarbox. It's called The Healing Moment. Each day I am newly reminded of my unworthiness. A dozen thoughts misspoken, another day when the good I do falls short of the good that I could do. A myriad of small interchanges, moments of sharing that strain to the breaking point, my desire to be generous, helpful, and kind. Months of careful work lost by a moment's impatience, a careless word. But when I am here at the edge of creation, breaking with the small tide over the sand, the need to do good rolls away. The question of what is right diminishes to insignificance and is easily borne away by the tiny waves. Here there are no words to be spoken. None are misspoken. I am with the broken stubble of the marsh grass that holds on through the wrecking wind and the burning flood. I am with the grains that mold themselves around everything, accepting even so unworthy a foot as mine, holding and shaping it until it feels that it belongs. I stand somewhere between truth and vision, and what I don't know ceases to embarrass me, because what I do know is that the water feels gentle like a lover's touch, and the sand welcomes it. What I have done or failed to do has left no noticeable mark on creation. What I do or don't do is of no moment now. Now I am here and grateful to be touched, calmed, and healed by the immense pattern of our universe. And when I die, it will be an honor for my blood to return to the sea and my bones to become the sand. Reassured, I am called back to my life, to another day. Let's stand and sing hymn 346, Come Sing a Song with Me. Come share your joys and sorrows with us. As we become a community of healing, regard your neighbor's gain as your gain and your neighbor's loss as your loss. For joys and sorrows, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone to come around.
I'm Jane Pelletier. I'm full of joy this morning. I have with me my sister Janifee Heal, who lives just south of Albuquerque, and my sister Joan Enriquez, who lives in Kingston, Mass., which is right next door to where Judy grew up. So a little bit of a connection there.
Shirley Hobrock. This morning we're saddened that one of our members is now resting in hospice house, Barbara Hacker. Her family, many of them are here. Her three kids are here. So we must keep her in our thoughts. And she is not allowed at the moment visitors. Is there a change now? Yes.
There was a message this morning that purpose within minutes or possibly hours or days of passing. And the family is going to allow people to come and see her briefly this afternoon between 12 and 2. And she's in room 11 at the hospice house. And they said, don't be shocked. She's lost a huge amount of weight, and she just doesn't look like the same person. So,
thank you for that. I'm sorry to hear that. I was probably going to cry anyway, but I'll still go through. I went to a professional conference last week. It's nothing that anybody cares about but me. And I saw a colleague, and I asked her how her daughters were doing. And she got really uncomfortable. We were out at one of the dinners that they offer, and I could tell she was trying to decide whether or not she wanted to share something or not. And then she went ahead and shared. This is somebody that I've known for about 2 years. She went ahead and shared that her older child is now male and goes by the name Asher. And that last year he was suicidal, and she thought she was going to lose him, and she didn't know why, and it had to do with identity issues and things like that. Anyway, I am joyful and proud that this family that lives in Iowa was able to find answers and reasons, and Asher is in a wonderful place, and I am grateful and proud that my friend was willing to share that with me. And that because of the training you all helped me go through to become an OWL instructor, I felt very capable and able of offering support to somebody that was struggling and sharing with that with people that she only sees once or twice a year. And so it turned out to be a really, really happy, happy occasion and happy moment. And so, thank you.
I'm Colleen Riley. I just wanted to share with you that I think 17 days ago now, my 37-year-old son suffered a heart attack. He had been having a heart attack for a week before the doctors discovered what it was. He was treating for stomach problems, and he had a 99% blockage in his LAD to his left ventricle, and only 2% of those are caught before death. Yeah, I know. The doctor, he had gone into the doctor again on his way to work, and the doctor did take a look at his levels, and it was up in his heart at that time, and he said, oh, yeah, you've got high levels. You need to be at the ER. You look okay. Do you need an ambulance? Gave him 4 aspirin and sent him to the hospital, which saved his life. The doctor said another 10 minutes with the blood clot that was forming would have been lights out. So he had to be rehospitalized 2 times after that, after he had a stent. With a lot of heart pain. Of course, he had suffered that a while, so the heart was pretty inflamed. But we're pretty optimistic about his recovery being fairly good.
I have a joy that I got to be the maid of honor at my best friend from high school's wedding in Phoenix, and I was accompanied by a very weary traveler who drove all the way from Kansas, my boyfriend Justin. So I'm glad that we both made it there and back safely, and we had a wonderful time. So we honor those joys and sorrows shared here today. For those left unspoken, we hold you in our hearts. Our singers are going to send a message that there's a light in the darkness, and there's a light that never fades. No matter what you're going through, we will stand with you.
Well, it has turned out to be a very kind of a heavy Sunday. This is an uplifting piece, but it was written in honor of the children at Sandy Hook. And so one more thing to think about healing.
Now time for our story of all ages. Children of any age, and even the young at heart, please come up and join me for a story, and then we'll sing them off to their RE classes. How are we doing today? Everybody looks a little sleepy. So, there's a lot of debates on television. What are people vying for? What's the goal? What do those two people want to be? president. That's right. Well, I struggled to pick a book today, but found one that seems pretty reasonable. President Penny Baker by Kate Pfeiffer. I have my lovely assistant, Michaela Vanna, over here. On a not too sunny and not too cloudy, not too hot but not too cold, Saturday afternoon in May, Luke Pennybaker asked his father one question because Luke Pennybaker wanted just one thing. Dad, he says, can I watch TV? His dad didn't say yes, as Luke thought he should have, and he didn't say no, as he usually did when Luke asked him if he could watch TV. Instead, he answered Luke's one question with five entirely new questions. Luke thought that that was unfair because one question deserves one answer, not five more questions. Did you clean your room? Did you eat your lunch? Did you brush your teeth this morning? Did you feed the fish? Did you ask your mother if she needs help with anything? No, 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 answered Luke. And then he asked again, so can I watch TV? This time his dad just gave him one answer. No. So Luke Pennybaker cleaned his room, ate his lunch, brushed his teeth, fed the fish, and asked his mother if she needed help with anything. Then he went back to his father and his one question. Dad, now can I watch TV? Luke Pennybaker's father looked at his son and said, no. It was at this very moment, this precise instant, that exact time and place that Luke realized life was unfair. A few moments later, after Luke yelled as loud as he could and was sent to his room, he decided that he would do whatever he could to make life fair. And so goes the story of how Luke Pennybaker became the youngest boy ever to run for president. She's right, it would be illegal. We're getting there. Luke went to school that Monday and announced his candidacy. Please vote for Pennybaker for president, he said. I promise to make life fair. I promise that if I'm elected president, you'll only have to do homework when you want to. I'd vote for that guy. It's not how it works, she's right. I promise that if I'm elected president, you'll be able to eat dessert any time of the day and go to sleep as late as you want to. And I promise that if I'm elected president, every child in America will get a dog or a cat or a hamster or a gerbil or a rabbit or an iguana. The children in Luke's school all cheered, Pennybaker for president! That week, they set up a campaign office and named Luke's dog, Lily, as the vice presidential candidate. I think that's illegal, too. They set up posters and called their cousins, asking them to send their pennies to the Pennybaker for President campaign. Luke and Lily spent the summer traveling around the country, campaigning. They campaigned on top of a mountain in Colorado and on the beach at the Jersey Shore. They campaigned in a candy store in Kansas. Yeah, we made it into a book. And at a dog show in Detroit. The rest of Luke's family came too, and they were just vacationing. On a campaign stop in New Hampshire, a reporter asked Luke what party he was in. Luke, are you in the Democratic or the Republican Party? Luke replied, I'm in the birthday party. He told the reporter that in the birthday party, kids get treated like it's their birthday every day of the year. They get to eat cake and ice cream and open presents every morning. They get to wear shorts in the winter and dirty clothes to fancy parties. That should be illegal. They get to play games at school and draw pictures during dinner. They can flood the bathroom when they take a bath and keep their rooms as messy as they want to. Later that summer, at a campaign stop in Iowa, a reporter asked Luke what was the first thing he would do as the youngest president in America. Luke replied, "Paint the White House orange." The other presidential candidates were asked what they thought about Luke's idea. One of the candidates said she thought the White House should be painted blue. The other candidate thought it should be painted red. But Luke liked orange, and it seemed like the rest of the country did too. By late summer, Luke and Lily were leading in the polls. Lily was named the most popular pup in the country. Happy Birthday became America's most sung song. We're tired of unfair. We want Penny Baker for president. Bark for the birthday party, roared the crowds. To show his support, the current president bought 40 gallons of orange paint and started to paint the White House. When he ran out of paint, he bought 40 more gallons and 40 more gallons and 40 more. By November, the White House was painted orange. On election morning, Luke went to cast his vote, but he was told he couldn't vote because he was too young. Luke went on TV to point out how unfair it was that he was not allowed to vote. Lily stood by his side and barked because she hadn't been allowed to vote either. "We'll vote for you," said the voters. Luke and Lily won the election by a landslide. He is too young. By a lot. It's a good story, though. In January, President Luke Pennybaker and Vice President Lily Pennybaker moved to the Orange White House and ordered cake, ice cream, and presents for every person and bones for every dog in America. But the mayor of New York did not like her present. She got an iguana. The senator of Maine was allergic to ice cream, and the governor of California wouldn't eat anything with sugar in it. And the dog of a city councilman in Cincinnati refused to chew on his bone. And the phone started ringing, and Lily wouldn't stop barking, and everyone wanted to talk to President Pennybaker. They needed him to come here and go there and look at this and look at that. And all President Pennybaker wanted to do was watch TV and ride his bicycle and read his books and play with his toys. He even wanted to clean his room, eat his lunch, brush his teeth, feed the fish, and help his mom. But he couldn't because he was far too busy being president, and it wasn't fair. So after the first week of being president, the youngest president in history stepped down. "I want to do what's fair," he said. He packed his bags and left the Orange White House. As he walked away, he turned around and he looked back. The new president was sitting near a window, looking out at Luke. Luke waved and yelled, "Good luck! I know you'll be fair." The new president nodded, picked up her paw, and barked back. The offering is a sign and symbol of our uniting together. Because we offer this fellowship, our time, treasure, and talent, we are able to do more together than we could ever do alone. And in that spirit, we now receive our offering. So healing the personal and the political. I have a book by Parker Palmer, A Hidden Wholeness. It's the journey toward an undivided life. There's just a couple of things I thought were pretty pertinent to today. Dividedness is a personal pathology, but soon it becomes a problem for other people. It's a problem for students whose teachers phone it in while taking cover behind their podiums and their power. It is a problem for patients whose doctors practice medical indifference, hiding behind self-protective scientific facade. It is a problem for employees whose supervisors have personnel handbooks where their hearts should be. It's a problem for citizens whose political leaders speak with forked tongue. The poet Rumi said, "If you are here unfaithfully with us, you are causing terrible damage. How shall we understand the pathology of the divided life? If we approach it as a problem to be solved by raising the ethical bar, exhorting each other to jump higher, and meting out tougher penalties for those who fall short, we may feel more virtuous for a while, but we are not addressing the problem at its source. The divided life is not a failure of ethics. It is a failure of human wholeness." So I'd like to share with you Clint Eastwood's movie clip from Invictus. Here, Morgan Freeman plays Nelson Mandela, just released from prison. He's taking office in a new freed South Africa after apartheid. We can learn from Mandela how to heal the personal and the political.
You ever feel like we should have trigger warnings every time you turn on the TV or open a laptop? 'Tis the season for political warfare. The gloves are not only off but have been discarded. The political discourse has reached gutter level, and we all wish we had British or Canadian-length elections. As the Irish-American cartoon Mr. Dooley said, politics ain't beanbag. No one needs to point out the depth of the political divides in our nation. We know that there are fewer people who identify as moderates, that the medians of the two major parties have drifted further and further apart, that the internet creates self-reinforcing bubbles where even facts become creations by one side or the other. Some of the divide feels abstract and is best depicted through graphs and charts. Pew Research documents that the growing ideological and social split between Democrats and Republicans. 48% of Americans live in what's called a landslide county. That is a county that votes for one party by more than a 20% margin. The Congress, the ultimate symbol of dysfunction due to partisan divide, only mirrors the rest of the country. The divides between parts of the country, rich and poor, white and people of color, men and women, educated and less educated, even rural and urban. And some of the divides, though, go right through our neighborhoods and families, distorting our relationships with people we are physically and emotionally close to. To me, that may be the most persuasive reason to talk about healing the divisions, even more compelling than whatever political ramifications exist. Whatever happens in this election, or the next one, or the next one, we have to live together. And maybe it's time we quit scheming for victory long enough to learn to listen to one another. President Obama, in his last State of the Union address, named it. He said, "It's one of the few regrets of my presidency that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better." Way back in the 70s, when I was a young adult, I internalized the message that the personal is the political. That message came from second-wave feminism. The idea was that when we sit down together and share the stuff of our lives, we discover that we've had similar experiences, experiences of powerlessness in the face of oppression and inequality. We realize that what we thought were idiosyncratic details of our home and family or even work lives were actually reliant on larger structures of oppression built into the system. We found that the political, the ways that laws systematically stripped women of autonomy and forced them to rely on fathers and husbands or even brothers and sons, shaped our political lives. The personal is the political, became the rallying cry. And decades later, I saw the same phenomenon demonstrated in faith-based community organizing. When we sat people down in small groups, we found that issues of unemployment and economic insecurity, over-incarceration, the lack of available and tremendous expense of health care, the challenge of caring for older relatives, poor schools for our children, dissatisfaction with roads, bridges, and sidewalks, that these and other issues that touched our personal lives profoundly were built into the political system and could not be fully answered through individual personal problem solving, but required collective action, which inevitably has some sort of political form. That lays out my bias, and I suspect some of you share it. So my perspective is that the personal and political issues are not as distinct as some people sometimes see them. I know that political systems can never eliminate all the hurdles we have in life, that certain harms we will always suffer alone, or at least while feeling alone, that handling things communally can mean in our families or with our friends and in our congregations, not always in a political subdivision. Many of our problems have a social dimension to them, but will not be solved politically, even at a local level. But many personal hurts are not only personal. I can't help but think about the one that we've been assaulted with in recent weeks in the political campaign, the verbal and physical harassment of women by men, especially powerful men. Few women in our society have escaped this. Despite the discomfort and even re-traumatization of hearing about it, despite the horrible way that the conversation started, it is good to have it out in the open and to realize that we have to do something about it. And those actions have to take place in multiple dimensions. On a personal level, women have to be willing to name it and contest it when it happens, even to name the past events in order to heal rifts with and fears of men. And men need to intervene when they hear such remarks from friends, not to mention repenting and committing to never again if they have ever personally been out of line. In our families, parents need to teach their children that their bodies are their own and how to respond to threats against that, as well as how to respect other people's bodies and dignity. In our institutional structures, we have to name and root out misogynist culture where it appears, protecting people who call out inappropriate sexual behavior, even when it comes from the powerful. And finally, in our government, we have to make sure that laws reflect the values that provide foundations for a culture of equality across genders. The further you get up on this scale, the more political the response becomes. The answer isn't purely political or purely personal. We need both. And that's true of so many other questions and problems of our lives. The interplay between the personal and political is huge, and we need healing in both. So huge are the connections that we can end up feeling like the personal is very political and vice versa, that the political is very personal, and that when our candidate or our issue is criticized, that we are being personally and unfairly attacked. From my own perspective, watching debates gets my back up. I can't do it without yelling at the TV. Even though in most of my life I am pretty mellow these days and my temper is really pretty well under control, but this stuff has me rankled, and I'm not the only one. According to Pew Research, 27% of Democrats think that the Republican Party is a threat to the nation's well-being, and 36% of Republicans think that the Democratic Party is a threat to the nation's well-being. That's pretty stark division. I heard on Being this morning with Krista Tippett, she had E.J. Dionne and David Brooks on, and E.J. Dionne said, we don't even know how to argue anymore because we don't know how to open ourselves up to one another's arguments. And I even have an internal division, not between the two parties, nevertheless a strong division. Part of me wants to issue the toughest Jeremiah ever, detailing blow by blow the potential devastation of the nation and its fundamental values that a Republican victory would have. The other part of me is worried about that kind of attack creating more negativity and further freezing the horrible gulfs between the two sides. When I consider it from a Taoist perspective, I understand that the more I resist the opposition, the more I strengthen it. The more I step back and recognize the interconnectedness of it, then the more diminished the differences can become. Yeah, that sounds really paradoxical. It is. So setting aside the specifics of political commentary, how do we address the need for healing as a religious community? How do we create a healing force within our larger community and even our nation? First, I have to remind us, myself as well as you, that liberal religion and liberal politics are two different things. Liberal religion, rejection of orthodoxy and commitment to the search rather than the answer. Liberal politics, endorsement of the values of liberty and equality, usually accompanied by a comfort with government action being used to pursue these values. People with liberal politics may embrace orthodox religion that offers clear moral answers. And people with liberal religion may reject the use of the state to achieve ends of liberty and equality. Nevertheless, many religious liberals are political liberals also. We have to recognize that both our politics and our religion are grounded in commitment to moral values. Politics, being the art of the possible, is usually better able to work through compromise with others with slightly different moral vision, but a similar commitment to the common good. At least that's been historically true, if rather iffy these days. I'm in awe of the people of South Africa. I know there have been great challenges in this and that their transition from apartheid was not painless. But I can't think of another such profound change in a society that took place without bloodshed and civil war. And that's a model we need to study. To even begin to embrace real commitment to a common good, we need to understand one another better and accept what we share and how we are different. Mandela purposefully gave up violence and learned about his opponents, learned their language, their way of life. And for me, it's useful to consider the people I know, people in my life whose values seem quite different from my own. It makes it harder to dismiss the arguments that I might otherwise shove aside as nonsense. Back in the 90s, when the country wasn't quite as divided as it is now, I lived in Madison, Wisconsin, a bastion of liberalism. The precinct I lived in was so liberal that in the 1996 presidential race, Ralph Nader came in second to Bill Clinton, beating Republican Bob Dole. But on the other hand, I met many thoughtful conservatives whose ideas stimulated and challenged me in a useful way. I was on the organizing team for a series of public events designed to help people from religious communities talk across the liberal-conservative divide. Once a month for about a year, an event featured a different topic: God, homosexuality, abortion, immigration, criminal justice, and so on. And each meeting featured the same format. People sat in small mixed groups around a table and shared a simple dinner, and then carefully selected speakers on two sides of the issue offered their perspective, speaking from their personal experience. And then a trained facilitator at each table invited the personal perspectives of those at the table. There were clear rules about sticking to speaking for ourselves, listening without interruption, no disparagement of others, etc., rules that would have been a breath of fresh air in the recent debates. I learned a lot from participating in that planning group. In terms of process, I found myself most often in agreement with the guy who was the furthest from me politically and religiously. Dave came from an independent Christian church, if I remember right, and wore little anti-abortion baby feet on his jacket lapel. We were the opposite poles of the conversation. What we both knew, though, was that no matter how successful our meetings were, talking like this wasn't going to actually lead to agreement on these tough issues, especially in a handful of interactions. And many of the liberals on the committee seemed to naively want to come to agreement. If we all just love one another, we'll find common ground. Kumbaya. So whenever the process veered toward what can we agree on, Dave and I were both ready to support one another in saying that this process was not about coming to agreement, only about coming to understand one another better. We can learn about one another, maybe even learn from one another, and still agree to disagree. We can respect one another without conforming to one another. Maybe in time, if we keep talking, we may find something else we agree on, but it's not going to be the hot topic, the hot button topics, not right away anyway. Now, I'm sure there are skeptics thinking, well, sure, liberals want to learn about others. We would be more open than conservatives to understanding each other. Surprise! Research shows that conservatives are better able to articulate a liberal's reasoning on controversial issues than vice versa. Why? Well, according to the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, conservatives have a broader palette of morals. They get that liberals are all about compassion, liberty, and equality, and they're not opposed to those things. Conservatives also know that they care about values that many of us liberals don't care so much about: loyalty, authority, and sanctity. Haidt's moral foundations theory, a much more sophisticated and nuanced view of morality than I had known previously, helps me comprehend the confusion of today's political realm. And I'm drawing a lot on his ideas in this part of this reflection. First, Haidt posits that our moral positions are not so much reasoned out as felt first. They actually register in our brains as feelings, not thoughts. And then we develop the reasoning to support our feelings. Here's what Haidt says about it. Morality binds and blinds. This is not just something that happens to people on the other side. We all get sucked into tribal moral communities. We circle around sacred values and then share post hoc arguments about why we are so right and they are so wrong. We think the other side is blind to truth, reason, science, and common sense. But in fact, everyone goes blind when talking about their sacred objects. Most of us, considering ourselves rational beings, do not want to accept that. But consider for a moment, if you're sympathetic to Syrian refugees, to what extent is that because of the picture of that little drowned boy that washed up on the Greek shore? Or other similar pictures and stories? That activated a caring and compassionate instinct, the same instinct that prompts parents to cuddle their infant. The people supporting refugee resettlement in large part are responding out of compassion, not because of a well-thought-out foreign policy. Both liberals and conservatives have compassion. Neither side wants to see children drowned or bombed. Conservatives, though, have additional moral foundations stimulated. They may also consider loyalty, to what degree we're on the same team and to what degree we can trust others not on the same team. Haidt talks about six sets of moral values grounded in evolution and brain biology. Care, which makes us sensitive to those who are suffering, particularly children and others who are most vulnerable. Fairness, which concerns itself with proportionality and whether people get what they deserve. Loyalty, which encourages us to embrace team players and join together in waving our flags and banners. Authority, which alerts us to signs of status and rank and encourages us to act within the status we have. Sanctity, which makes us shy away from impurities, including parasites and pathogens, but gets generalized to systems of purity, the sacred and profane, and finally, liberty, which provokes resistance to bullies and tyrants alike. So we may respond to situations based on how they line up with or diverge from these moral scales in ways we approve of. then we make up our reasoned responses to justify our point of view. This is what Haid has observed. Think about it this way. There are behaviors that most of us would view as wrong that could be awfully hard to explain away. Cannibalism. Well, sure, it's wrong to kill someone to eat them. But why would eating people be wrong if a society decided in a safe way to deal with their dead that way? That probably kind of creeps you out. That's that disgust center in your brain yelling, it's just wrong. Incest. Yes, we know there are genetic problems with it in some situations, power differentials that make it clear that someone is taken advantage of. But if you look at an adult brother and sister who are not producing children, is it still wrong? What about two gay brothers? Cannibalism and incest are both examples of moral reactions in the area of sanctity that can be hard to rationally explain. Liberals, according to Haid, tend to let the moral dimension of caring trump, so to speak, other dimensions. Garrison Keillor put it this way, I'm a liberal, and liberalism is the politics of kindness. Liberals stand for tolerance, magnanimity, community spirit, the defense of the weak against the powerful, love of learning, freedom of belief, art and poetry, city life, the very things that make America worth dying for. And beyond that, in terms of morality then, if nobody's getting hurt, so what? John Stuart Mill may have been the first to articulate this principle in 1859, saying the only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. With that criteria, we don't worry too much about all the icky things, just the truly harmful ones. Most of the world, though, has strong moral fences around the icky things, too. Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic people. Have you heard that before? Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. The abbreviation is WEIRD. Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic people actually test oddly compared to the rest of the world about moral dimensions. Oddly about how we tend to look at the world. Our tendency, what I'd call it an enlightenment mindset, is to see the world as individual objects, to see people as individual beings, and not so much to see the relationships and the tribe as primary. But most of the world sees relationship first. They're embedded in place and family and social network. Individual rights do not make so much sense in such a worldview. Morality around loyalty, authority, and sanctity may be seen as a way of supporting the interrelated group. The challenge for us as liberals is that we may recognize these values as legitimate for people on the other side of the world, but we have trouble allowing them to the people up the street. Have you ever listened to... let me try to do this in the right order. but we do have access to some of those other moral dimensions. I talked a little bit about the sanctity one. Loyalty. Many of us might consider it wrong to criticize one of our family members outside the family while it's okay inside the family. She's my sister. Don't you say anything about her. Loyalty creates team sports, galvanizes religious communities, evokes patriotism. Haid gave an example that he had an irrational impulse to put an American flag on his car after 9/11. He had to fight his uncharacteristic compulsion, reminding himself that that wasn't his politics, and finally settled on putting on an American flag and a UN flag. Have you ever listened to John Lennon's Imagine with the liberal vision of oneness because of no countries or no religion? And have you ever thought even a little, it's a nice idea, but we'd soon deteriorate as some people took advantage of others. So maybe you can see the benefits of having loyalty or maybe even structures of authority. So it's complicated. It's not all one way or the other. But liberals tend to base their moral judgments on care and liberty and to a lesser extent on fairness, that is proportionality, while conservatives tend to use all six of the moral frameworks. And Haid suggests that when people vote against what appears to be their own interests, they're often responding to moral agreement, to moral arguments they agree with. So are they responding emotionally instead of rationally? Yes, but all of us are. Researchers have demonstrated that social and political judgments rely on quick, intuitive flashes. We can even go back to our genetic profiles to distinguish liberals and conservatives a bit. There are two genetically based predictors that stand out: threat sensitivity and openness to experience. Our brains have differing amounts of sensitivity to different aspects of the environment, and conservatives tend to be more sensitive to threats, while liberals tend to be attracted to new experiences. So there are actual brain differences. The world looks very different to conservatives and liberals. Yet we do all want the world to be a better place. We want to increase pro-social behaviors and decrease antisocial behaviors. We want to live together in peace. But we may approach it differently. Liberals have more faith in human goodness, while conservatives think you need more constraints, rules, customs, even social controls like gossip. When I lived in Petersburg, West Virginia, a little town with one stoplight and about 2,000 people, the crime rate was extremely low. People left their cars running in front of the post office. They didn't lock their doors. And people in Petersburg, West Virginia, are no better than anybody else. They didn't commit crimes because the social fabric was so thick that you would be caught, because you had out-of-control gossip all the time. You couldn't go out of town or into town without everyone knowing your business. It could be suffocating, but it was safe. Much more set up for conservatives than for liberals. Liberals would rather live in a freer place with more diversity and higher crime, but Petersburg had high moral capital, the resources that sustain a moral community. So we need both social cohesion and growth and change. John Stuart Mill said that we need a party of order, stability, and a party of progress and reform. So what do we need to heal? More appreciation of the other, more positive social connections. President Obama held a White House convening on building community trust, a meeting including police, Black Lives Matter activists, and community leaders. And later he said this about the meeting: that's the path out of moments like this, not to withdraw or shout each other down, but to reach out to each other, even if it's difficult, and find some common ground. Or as Mandela said, reconciliation starts here, forgiveness starts here. I don't know the answer, but South Africa gives me hope. I don't know that we can solve it on the national scale, much less the world scale, but I'm convinced that on the local scale, the closest to the personal, we can make a difference. We can get to know one another and slowly bring about a change in the culture. David Brooks traveled the country recently trying to figure out how he had been so wrong. He says he had written millions of columns on how Donald Trump could not win the nomination. And he discovered the pain out there, but he also found something else. He said, everywhere I went, there were healers. Relationships turn around lives. And maybe that is the personal that will help solve the political. At least that is my hope. Our closing hymn is in the Teal Book. It's number 1021, Lean on Me. I invite you to rise in body or spirit. Mm-hmm. May the love that overcomes all differences, that heals all wounds, that puts to flight all fears, that reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us, now and always.